There's a stranger here that's a stranger to some of you, but not to all of you. And I want to introduce to you the lead pastor of Vernon Alliance Church in the 1990s, Reverend Ian Trigg. And so, Ian, before I get off the platform, because I'm talking too much tonight, first question is, why are you here?
I was invited to be a part of a memorial service today. Some of you may have known Ron Fisher, Ron and Cheryl, Cheryl Tkach. Some of you might remember Cheryl if you're old-timers here. And Ron passed away 6 months ago today. And with all things COVID and complexities and everything, they waited until this weekend and they asked if I would come back. When they asked me, I was living in Calgary and it seemed like, that's a good thing to do. I always like to go to Vernon. And then I moved. So it got a little more complicated, but I was still able to get back here. Okay. So that's why I'm here.
Well, Ian, it seems appropriate. Again, when I hear memories about you, your pastoral way with people, your care and shepherding way is always what's brought up. So it's only fitting that you're here because of a funeral. So you hinted at it, but tell us... I know that there you've been the lead pastor of Foothills Alliance Church in Northwest Calgary ever since you've left Vernon. That's 20 years, and now there's been a change. So what's up with that?
You know, I always thought the most foolish thing I ever did in my life was to leave Vernon to go to Calgary. And now I've left Calgary to go to Toronto. I mean, think that one through. Just not in 100 years that I ever think I'd ever live east of the city of Calgary, city limits. But this summer, God whispered into my heart that there was I thought my last leadership mountain to climb would be to lead our church out of all things COVID. But God whispered to me to go, and we have our church, Alliance Church across Canada, is broken into six districts, and this is a Canadian Pacific district that we're in here in BC, and there's one in Ontario called the Central Canadian District, CCD. I just call it the crazy chaotic district, but that's another story. Hope no one's listening. But they tried to elect a district superintendent last June, and they failed. You have to have a certain percentage of vote for whoever wins, and they didn't get it. So it fell into the lap of our president to appoint a DS for a two-year appointment, and he asked me to do it. And it's the silliest thing I've ever done, but I just deeply, deeply felt like God said, I'm supposed to do this. I thought when I told Joyce or talked to her about it, she'd say, that's great. We're sure going to miss you here in Calgary. But she didn't say that at first. She eventually got there, but she didn't say it at first. So she's still in Calgary. We're working on a distance thing for a few more months. She's coming out for 2 weeks this week. That's why she's not here right now. But we're finding our way. I'm doing a hybrid Calgary 2 weeks there for a couple of weeks. Until probably the end of March, and then she'll be there with me, and we're figuring it out. And you know what? It's where I'm supposed to be. It was hard to leave here, and it was hard to go there, but it's what I'm supposed to do.
Ian, you've served people well in the church for many years. We're confident you'll continue to do so in this role, and we're delighted to have you minister to us tonight. So welcome to Vernon.
Thanks, bye. I'm going to destroy all time barriers, which I used to do all the time, but let me just say this. I don't know who's all here, but Wayne, and might have been Ed Devlin, Wilf's dad probably, Tuck maybe, a whole pile of people were elders back in the day. The very best decision I think we ever made was to start Saturday night church. And of all the places I could ever be on a Saturday night if I had to be in church, this is where I would want to be. And nothing's changed in 20 years of not being here. It is amazing to be here. It's just remarkable. And you've inspired my heart tonight. Worship is just so impactful and meaningful. So bless you for your faithfulness and for perseverance. And let me just say this about Jason. I've known Jason for quite a while. We've had a really cool relationship until he stole my youth pastor. And then, it was a little tense there between Cochrane and Calgary. But I'm mostly over that. But, in my time here, I probably was an okay shepherd. And when Ricky came after me, an amazing visionary leader, especially for hurting, vulnerable people. And then Stuart, you know, teacher extraordinaire. You know what, Jason? You get a little bit of all that. He's a better than good Bible teacher. And he's a really, really brilliant leader. And he really cares for people. And he loves you. And when he and I met for about 4 hours in a Dairy Queen on the west side of Calgary to talk about the potential of this, my heart was full. Because I still love this place. And I'm just so grateful that Jason Kaliba is your senior pastor, your lead pastor. He's a good, good man. Care well for him and his family. And I know you will. Because that's just what you guys do as a church. So if the fact that I tell you that I live in Ontario doesn't make you laugh, let me add to it. Not only am I a district superintendent, I am the president of a nursing home. Hey, is that not brilliant? 128 residents directly under my care. So pray for them, because our district owns a nursing home and I'm the president. Every time, I just say it for the laugh effect, because it just makes me laugh. And that I've been in a lot of churches in Ontario, and I stand up and I say, I love the Toronto Raptors, and I love the Toronto Blue Jays, but for the life of me, I could never fathom myself saying, go Leafs, go. It just cannot ever happen. And that, so. Every night in my childhood, probably, almost every night, I exaggerate a lot, I heard these words. My mother would call my name in a way that was really embarrassing, so I won't tell you that because you're just cruel enough that you'll do it all the time. But she'd call out and she'd say, Ian, come inside now. It's getting dark outside. And it was my mother's nightly phrase that ended my fun with friends hundreds of evenings as a child growing up. Many a game of road hockey and kick the can and backyard baseball and bike riding and hide and go seek and throwing a football and just hanging out found its demise in the dreaded reality of imminent nightfall. Because when it was dark outside, you were expected to be inside. And as I told my kids 100 times, by the way, Kyle phoned me today. He's so jealous that I'm here. He wishes he could be here. And if you heard him preach lately, you'd wish he was here too. Because, you know, I always said Kyle was just so much far beyond where I was at his age. Now I just say Kyle's far beyond me. And he preached, I was in church for Thanksgiving at First in Calgary, where he's my son, he's pastor here too. And he preached the same passage I preached 4 months ago. And I just felt like I should drive to Foothills and repent and apologize to my congregation. Because like what he did with that text was like 100 times better than what I did with it when I preached it a few months before. But they had a little girl, they named her Eleanor, which is sweet and cute and old. And, you know, so I thought, Ellie, you know, L. Or Nora, you know, Nora, that's good. And not so much. Hope he's not watching this. Lenny. They call my sweet, beautiful, perfect granddaughter Lenny. It's killing me. Now, anybody 40, you probably think it's a cool name. Like, you probably think this is awesome. But if you're over 40, you grew up with Laverne and Shirley and Lenny and Squiggy, and it just kills you to think that a perfect, beautiful little granddaughter, and she's all of that. You know, when Charlotte was born, I thought Charlotte was the best baby ever born. And then Alexander was born 2 years later, and I realized Charlotte's like a terrorist compared to her brother, who was just so, and then, now he's a terrorist, and now Eleanor is sweet and adorable and perfect. But anyways, he says hello. I told my kids, and Kyle especially, 100 times, nothing good ever happens after midnight. I'm sure you've heard it if you're a kid. You should be home where nothing bad ever happens. Yeah, right. The danger of darkness is like the law of gravity. Few of us can explain it, but somehow we're all convinced of it. I mean, think about our houses today. You know, at night we light them up with unrelenting, ferocious zeal. You know, fluorescent lights and incandescent lights and recessed lights and flashlights and floodlights and motion detecting. We are obsessed with lights, street lights, stop lights, hazard lights, headlights, taillights, halogen lights, neon lights, night lights. There's a $1 billion industry dedicated to our lighting fixation, providing ambient lighting and accent lighting and task lighting. And why? What did people do like 150 years ago? You know, before Thomas Edison. I mean, they slept. You know, they slept more, is what they did. Came across a book by a woman named Barbara Brown Taylor, and it's called Learning to Walk in the Dark. And in it, she says, when I look around at our world today, it seems clear that eliminating darkness is pretty high on the human agenda. And not just physical darkness, but metaphysical darkness, which includes, you know, psychological, emotional, relational, spiritual darkness. And darkness is fear. And the one thing we fear most is we fear being afraid. But then she talks about there are things, though, that can only be learned in the dark, that transform lives over and over again, that we could never learn in the light. And I mean, in the church, we've pursued this Pursue Light crusade. You know, we've, you know, dark means evil. It's the dark one, the enemy of our souls. And dark is evil, and it's sinful, and it's bad. And we like to talk about the good things that God does for us. We're big on benefits, but what about when life is hard? And I don't have to look very far into this congregation to see all kinds of you who've walked through so much hard stuff. And sometimes it's just so hard. So is God absent? Is God indifferent? Is God gone? Is he on vacation? I heard a guy say the other day, I believe in God. It just seems like he's really preoccupied with other people right now because he's not doing anything for me. And that's how we feel like, no, yeah, okay, God, you're there. I get that. Don't want to say there's no God because that might not be a good thing to do. But really, do you see? Do you know? Do you care? It's how we're left feeling sometimes. What do we do when our kids struggle? What do we do when we're stuck in a pandemic that is polarizing? Not just churches, families, communities, hospitals. It's a complicated world that we live in. What do we do when work is hard? When marriage is brutal? When kids go sideways? What about when church is complicated? What do you do when you're a pastor and you feel really tired and weary? And you don't have a church that says, take some time. We'll pray for you. We love you. You're so blessed. You know it. And pray for him. Because what he's going through, in my new role as a DS, I pastor pastors. And there are so many that are so weary. And there's not a lot of elder boards that are saying, take some time to be well. Because we love what you do, but we love you even more. So bless you, church, for taking care of your team. What if being afraid of the dark, what if instead of that we learn to walk in the dark? Now, my experiences with darkness have been limited, I admit. I've had steady work my adult life. My children mostly like me. I think my wife does too, although she has not moved to Ontario yet. So probably should think that one through a bit. I've never been sexually abused. I've had health challenges, but never cancer. I've experienced emotional brokenness, but never to the deepest, darkest depths like some have. I'm very grateful for the blessings of my life. This church is one of the largest ones. But I know that challenges come. And I know about spiritual darkness. I'm familiar with the feeling that perhaps God has forgotten me or isn't overly concerned with my place in life. I've got a friend who she smilingly says, I know that God says somewhere in the big book that, you know, God will never give us more than we're able to manage in life. But right now I sense that God is seriously overestimating my coping abilities. And we've all been there. I've been afraid of people. I've been too concerned with people and their opinions of me. I've questioned the wellness of my soul. I've lost sleep at night worrying about my kids. What do we do, especially when those dark nights of the soul become dark weeks and dark months and dark years? And sometimes, if we're honest, dark decades. Where's God in the midst of those moments? Well, here's my thought for us tonight. That even when light fades, even when darkness falls, as it does every single day in every single life, God does not turn the world over to some other deity. Even when we feel vulnerable, when nobody seems to answer us when we call, when we're feeling kind of like invisible, like God's preoccupied with something else, someone else, that's not sufficient proof that we've been left alone. So, church, I want to just say tonight that sometimes God does some of his best work in our souls, in those wilderness, desert, dark seasons of life. And we need to stop being afraid of the dark. And we need to be perhaps intrigued by the dark. And to realize it might be the best classroom we ever find ourselves in. That's a bold thing to say, but let me flesh it out in the story of Moses, chapter 3 of Exodus, if you have a Bible or a phone, a tablet or something. Quick summary, if you remember the story. Children of Israel ended up in Egypt. God was superintending over all kinds of things through Joseph's life. And they end up there, and they're being blessed, and they're being cared for and provided for. But then decades went on, and years and years and years went on. And then all of a sudden, the new king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, wasn't quite as enamored with the Jews, the Israelites, and made life hard and started making them work and turned them into slaves and then made it harder. And then just when you thought you couldn't bear anymore, he made it harder. And so the Israelites are in this really, really difficult place. And then he decides, I'm going to practice genocide here. And I'm just going to, because there's too many of the Jews, they keep reproducing too fast. And I'm going to wipe them out, and I'm going to kill the firstborn males, and or the males that are born. And so there's a little baby that's born to a little Hebrew slave woman. And she can't bear the thought that her child's going to be killed, so she hides him. And then eventually she knows she can't hide him any longer, so she creates a basket and puts some stuff in it so it doesn't sink, and she lays her baby in it and tells her, you know, watch what happens here. And she lays the baby into the water at a place where a lot of Egyptian women would gather, and she prayed that one with compassion might see this child, and that's exactly what happened. And the one that saw the child was the Pharaoh's daughter. And she said, this must be one of the Hebrew babies. I'm going to raise this kid. And Moses, drawn out of the reeds, was born into privilege, was raised as a prince of Egypt. But he always knew his story somehow. Actually, his mother nursed him. It's kind of an amazing story how it all worked, Exodus 1 and 2. So the way that it unfolds is that Moses has got a heart for these people. And one day he sees an Egyptian mistreating a Hebrew slave. And he's angry. You're taking advantage of my people. And so he looks around and nobody's there, and he pummels the Egyptian. He actually kills him. Gets really worried, buries the guy in the sand. Next day he's walking along and he sees two Hebrews fighting each other. And he goes, guys, what are you doing? We're family. Like, what are you doing? Don't do this. And the one guy looks at him and he goes, are you going to kill us like you killed that Egyptian yesterday? And Moses was terrified because he knew somebody saw what happened. And he fled Egypt. And if you know the story of Exodus chapter 3, he ended up in the wilderness. Let's read about it real fast. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness. So he wasn't just a little bit in the weeds. He wasn't just a little bit in the dark. He wasn't just a little bit in. He was in the far side. He was deep in. And it wasn't just that he was there for a really short period of time. It had been 14,000 days. 40 years. That he'd had this wilderness experience. And while he learned how to lead in the courts of Pharaoh, I'd suggest that he learned how to be a man of God in the desert, in the wilderness, in the darkness. Well, he's out there by himself, wondering what has happened to my life, I'm sure, because we always ask those questions in those moments. And suddenly, he saw a bush. It was on fire, but it wasn't being consumed. We know a little bit about fires and their consuming capacity in this part of the world. And he said, I'm going to go over there and check this out. Why is the bush not burning up? And when he got there, God called him and said, Moses. And he said, here I am. And he said, take off your shoes, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. And he said, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at the face of God. And we have this remarkable reminder that God steps into our stories. And sometimes in moments that we could never have imagined. It's often in the ordinary, everyday circumstances of life that God shows up and does something altogether extraordinary. And that's exactly what happened here. The bottom line that I want us to understand tonight is that the God that we serve, as we sang about, is God who makes a way in the darkness. He's working even when we can't yet see it. And we can either choose to despair or make a fist and put it in his face and say, whatever are you doing? Or we can say, help. And find grace to help and mercy in our time of need, Hebrews 4:16. I think it's really important to note at the same time that the Hebrew slaves were crying out to God for deliverance in Egypt, that God was commissioning a shepherd on the backside of a mountain in a desert hundreds of miles to the southeast, preparing him to lead them to freedom. It's a remarkable story. He had been a prince, he'd been a hero, and now he's a fugitive. And yet God had a plan and a purpose for his life, even when he had a hard time seeing it. Let me just skip stuff here. God steps into our stories. And not only that, he steps into our stories with a beautiful plan. Verse 7 is one of my favorite verses in all of the scriptures. So God's in the bush, calls him to pay attention. And then he said to him, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering. I have come to rescue them. What I want to say to us tonight is that God that we serve is a God who sees, and he's a God who hears, and he's a God who cares. And church, he's a God who intervenes. With all of my heart, I believe that to be true, and with all of my heart, I know that there's an enemy of God that seeks and wants us to believe otherwise. He wants us to think that God doesn't see what's happening, doesn't care about what's going on. It wasn't true in Moses' day. It's not true in our day. You know, when Jesus was sleeping in the boat, you know, the bottom of the boat, and they're crossing the sea, and a big storm came, and the boat's being tossed to and fro, and they're all terrified, and they went and woke up Jesus, and Jason, what did they say to him? Don't you care that we all drown? And let's just be really, really honest. It's often our first reaction. When life gets complicated, when things go sideways, when things don't work out, the girl doesn't like it the way you want her to, and the guy says, you know, let's just be friends. And, you know, and like when kids go sideways, when jobs go sideways, when health goes sideways, when church gets difficult, it's easy for us to think, God, don't you care? Don't you see? Don't you know? Can't you hear me? It's a little bit of a first reaction that we go through. If God is light and I'm in the dark, then God must be gone. It is so easy and not helpful to make our judgments about God and his character based on our circumstances. And we must learn rather to make judgments on our circumstances based on what we believe about God. He's good and he's kind and he's with us and he's for us. And perhaps the most important truth from Hebrews 13, he'll never leave us or forsake us. What happened must have blown Moses away. The voice of God saying, I know what's going on in Egypt. It's remarkable. Darkness is not dark to God. Night is as bright as the day. He sees and he cares and he's at work and he's going to be trusted. I was thinking about this. The most impactful sermon for me that I ever taught in this church was right here. And I taught it with a guy named Ed Kalanko. And a couple of you might remember. Ed was this guy that lived out in Grinrod. He was the toughest man I knew. Scared the life out of me, actually. One day he had 20 acres of land along the Shuswap River in Grinrod, and he turned it into a park. Like, it was just an amazing piece of property. And one day he was painting the soffitting on his barn, and he was had to back the dump truck up and put a 2x10 across, and he had his granddaughter as a ballast on the other side, and he was on this side trying to reach the final piece of the soffit. And then his beautiful wife called and said, it's lunch. And he said to his daughter, you go, honey, I'll be right there. And she goes, be careful, Grandpa. He goes, I'll be careful. And he reached just a little bit further, and all of a sudden the board flipped. It was 6 feet. Ed was 6 feet tall. He didn't have any time to even duck his head. He landed right on the top of his head, and he broke his neck. We'd been camping out in the Shuswap. We'd just come in that afternoon. Gwen called from the church and said, Ian, I don't know how to tell you this, but Ed Kalanko's in trouble. He broke his neck, they think. He's in hospital in Kelowna. And I said to Joyce, I got to go. And she said, go. And I drove as fast as I could humanly drive, daring an RCMP member to pull me over. And I got to the hospital, and I walked in, and his wife had, Louise had just gone for supper. And I walked into Ed's room, and he was rugged and strong. His skin was brown from the sun, and he had a halo deal screwed into his head on his shoulders to stabilize his neck. And I walked in, and I, what am I going to say? And I took his hand, and I said, Ed. And he opened his eyes. And he goes, I can't turn my head. Get your face over mine. And I leaned over. And he said, and he smiled. He said, Ian, I think I really did it this time. I can't feel a thing. I don't know what I said to him. They were evacuating him to Vancouver in a few hours. We prayed and cried. And about 7 or 8 months after that, Ed was in a wheelchair. He got some movement in his shoulders, a tiny bit in his hands. And he preached. And somehow we got him up on stage here, and he was here, and I was there. And I was doing the story of Jesus in the boat, and Ed was illustrating it. And it was there. This congregation never listened as carefully as they did to Ed Kalanko that day. And I remember saying to him, I said, Ed, it says in the Bible, not to say in the Bible, it says somewhere, some idiot, some guys came up with this. You know, we can live 40 days without food and 8 days without water and 4 minutes without air, but 1 second without hope. And I said, what's your hope? And he said, my hope. And he wheeled his chair right to the edge. This is change, but right to the edge. And he looked at us all. And he said, my hope is my Bible. It says that one day I will stand in the presence of Jesus. It doesn't say I'll sit. It's powerful. But I asked him, I said, Ed, you claim that you've not had a moment of depression in these last 8 months since your injury. Wouldn't call it an accident, because that would mean God didn't know what was going on. He called it an injury. I said, you say you have no depression. How can that be? In church, he said something that I think comes out of our text today. He said, it's been hard, and some days are really tough. I look at my wife and I realize what she's going through, and it breaks my heart. He said, but for the last 50 years of my life, I gave the first hour of every day to Jesus. And I read the scriptures and I talked to him about my life. And I invited him to speak into my life. I've had 50 years to get to know the heart of God. And I decided a long time ago that no matter what comes my way, I can trust him. He discovered that God sees and God hears, and God cares, and God steps into our stories. And nowhere do we find that more clearly than in this table that Jason's going to walk us through.